This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are diving beneath the headlines today with Governor Charlie Baker, who will be, of all things, the next president of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA. He starts in March, leading 1,104 schools across three divisions and more than a half million student athletes, according to the NCAA itself.
I think it's wonderful. I've never met a sports fan as big as Charlie Baker in my entire life. I think he's perfect for this role. I'm so happy for him.
That's Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican writer and activist, reacting to the news real time on our show yesterday. Baker will lead an organization as it faces legal and moral challenges.
My first reaction was, if Charlie Baker thinks it's been tough to govern Massachusetts, wait till he moves to Indianapolis.
And that is Andrew Zimbalist reacting yesterday to WBUR reporter Walter Wuthman. He's a professor of sports economics at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and is here with us today along with YW president and CEO, former college and pro basketball player Beth Chandler, and Victor Matheson, a professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester. We want to get down into, okay, what's going to make Governor Baker maybe particularly good at this, maybe particularly challenge him? How does it stack up against being the governor of a $52 billion state? So welcome to all three of you, Beth here in Studio 2.
Hi, good morning.
Andrew on the line.
Good morning.
And Victor on the line as well.
Happy to be here.
So Victor, I'll stay right with you since you were the last to speak. Reactions to this, did you see it coming yesterday?
Yeah, I haven't talked to anyone who expected this. I certainly, the first thing when I heard the news was I ran down the hall and said, you cannot believe the news about Charlie Baker. So I think that took everyone by surprise.
True for you too, Beth?
Yes.
And definitely. Did you say, okay, that tracks, or what?
I think I was more the what.
And how about you, Andrew?
I was in the what category.
Yeah, and okay, so listen, in a second ago, we played you saying, if this man thinks it was tough to lead Massachusetts, wait till he moves to Indianapolis. Now, we now know he's not going to move to Indianapolis, where the NCAA is located, but you seem to think, Andrew, that this is a very big job.
The NCAA is falling apart. It has lost a number of important antitrust cases in the last 10 or 15 years. It's now afraid to implement its legislation. The system is running amok. We have through the advent of NILs, name, image, and likeness income from third parties exploding. Some people are earning six figures. Some athletes are earning into the seven figure range, according to different reports. We have also something called a transfer window where college athletes are allowed to move from one school to another, and schools are very actively participating and trying to raid each other's stock of athletes. So we have chaos right now, and it's just getting worse and worse. And the system needs to be brought under control in one form or another, whether it's properly regulating the NIL market or it's completely deciding to marketize the labor market in college sports, or it's some other model. The NCAA has been unable to lead and give any direction to this process. The court system in the U.S. is very, very, very fickle and capricious, and a lot of judges are making decisions that...
So I'm going to jump in on you there, Andrew. Yeah. Thank you. But for listeners who may not know the background and everything you're talking about, the key thing I want them to understand is this name, image, and likeness, relatively new. It's the right of college athletes to earn money with the use of their own name, image, and likeness. The courts have created a position on that that now makes it possible, but we have a patchwork of rules across the different states that, to use your word, and I think it's an apt word, chaos, has ensued. And one of the challenges is trying to get the federal legislature to come up with something that would be more standard. So you've underscored the chaos widely there. I want to turn to Victor for just a second, because Victor, the other piece in this now is the question of college sports gambling as well. So for example, in Massachusetts, now legal to bet on sports. We're still putting out the framework, but you will not be able to bet on Massachusetts college teams unless they're competing in a tournament outside the state, but college gambling will be legal here. That's another big issue for the NCAA, correct?
Sure, and of course, this is an issue that they brought upon themselves. The Red Sox and the Celtics aren't afraid of expanded gambling in Massachusetts because Jason Tatum, the star of the Celtics, he's making $30 million a year. And so it's pretty hard for him to be bribed to be able to throw any games here. But again, with the NCAA still insisting on trying to hold on what pieces of their athlete cartel they still have, college athletes are still very vulnerable to potential match corruption and match fixing. In fact, even in the late 70s, we had a scandal here at Boston College related to match fixing. So again, exploding gambling, just another thing on the extremely crowded plate of Charlie Baker.
So Beth Chandler, I'm going to turn to you now, and I'm going to play you two pieces of sound. First, Victor just mentioned Boston College there. Yesterday, WBUR's Walter Wuthman spoke with Blake James, who's the athletic director there, who's expressed some optimism about Baker's leadership and solutions.
I think at the point we're at with college athletics right now, a fresh look to who we are is something that is going to be a real win for the student athletes, and it's going to be a real win for all the institutions involved in the association.
And I also want to play Jackie Jenkins Scott. She was also on the show yesterday. She's the interim president of Roxbury Community College. She had Lions Bill Walczak reacted real time with us as the news came out about a half an hour before the show. Here she is.
I think it's good for collegiate sports. I think it's great for Charlie Baker because he is a sports fan. And I hope it's good for women in sports. We have a long way to go.
500,000 student athletes. We've talked about the gambling. We've talked about the court cases, antitrust, name, image, likeness. What about the kids?
Yeah, I mean, equity is a big issue in the NCAA. That was a couple of years ago when we looked at the women's college basketball tournament and what the facilities they had versus what the men had.
I mean, itty-bitty set of weights compared to
Exactly. Entire
weight rooms.
And so that's another issue that I worry about is just equity within college sports, both looking at different size schools as well as what's happening for athletes and particularly women athletes. And, you know, I think Governor Baker has done lots of things for women in the state, but women of color, I think there's been a miss. And so I just wonder, you know, I think as everybody has talked about, there needs to be significant change for the NCAA. And I don't know what he's done that's been transformational in Massachusetts. That doesn't mean he's bad or not the right person, but I think the NCAA needs to be transformed. And I just don't know what he's done to transform such a system like that.
So here with Beth Chandler, Andrew Zimbalist, Victor Matheson, we are talking about Charlie Baker, governor of Massachusetts, his new appointment as the NCAA president. We just laid out kind of what the challenges of the organization are, what the stakes of the job are, and Beth has begun to lead us into, okay, let's look at Charlie Baker and the job. And I want to stay with that thread now. Here's a little sound from Baker talking about the job himself yesterday at a virtual press conference.
I really do think that the enthusiasm, the life and professional experiences I've had, the relationships I have, can be a big part of helping all the folks involved in the NCAA, wherever they fit, benefit from what we can put together going forward if we work together. And I really do think the challenge is significant, but the possibilities and the opportunities, if we are successful, are enormous. And I'm very honored and grateful for this chance to serve.
So, Andrew, you know, you're the one who said, I've said it twice already, big, big job. You know, the Commonwealth is a $52 billion, nearly $53 billion state. The executive branch, 42,000 employees. But that's not the only indication of a big or hard job. Do you see things in Charlie Baker's experience over the last 8 years that give you confidence that he can tackle what seems to be, from listening to you, a really unique set of organizational challenges across an entire country? And I don't want to lose the fact that he's one of the most popular governors in the United States and has been for 8 years as well. So, Andrew Zimbalist.
Well, I've worked a little bit with Charlie, and I have a great respect for him as a manager, and I think he's a smart individual. He doesn't have experience with college sports. The fact that he played 1 year JV at Harvard or that his kids played college football doesn't qualify him to understand the complexities of the NCAA. As NCAA president, he is going to be tightly circumscribed and controlled by board of directors and management councils. He doesn't have independent authority. It's pretty clear to me that he was hired not to solve gender equity issues, not to solve racial issues, but to get the Congress to pass an antitrust exemption for the NCAA. He's likely to be somewhat effective in that role. I think it's still a Herculean task because Republicans and Democrats disagree with each other, but within each caucus, there's a lot of disagreement. And if you look at the kind of legislation that was put out in this last Congress, there were 7 or 8 interesting reform bills. They're requiring all sorts of different changes. And if especially the Democrats can be expected to grant the NCAA additional monopoly power, then it will have to be part of a broader reform effort. And so it's not so simple as to go to Congress and say, we need the antitrust exemption. You have to put it together with a package that's coherent and holistic.
So
I don't know if Charlie has the ability to do that. And that's not a knock on Charlie. It's just a statement of the complexity of the task.
So question mark there from Andrew Zimbalist. Beth Chandler, I'll come back to you. You've raised one question mark about transformation already. I'm mindful of the last time you were sitting here in Studio 2. We were talking about an LGBTQ plus exhibit on Boston Common. And one of the issues that's really coming to the fore that the NCAA will have a say in, I think if I understand it correctly, is the status of trans athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels like one of the new frontiers where we talked about this being sort of a business challenge and a moral challenge,
right,
coming together. Can you talk about that or reflect on that a little bit, what you see the challenges there being?
I think, the challenge is that there's a lot of pressure that people don't want trans athletes competing as they identify. And that, I think, is going to be a challenge. You see it at different states where some states are allowing it, some states are not allowing it. And how do you make a decision on that, given that this is a body that's governing over the country and certain parts of the country aren't going to be supportive? So I think it's going to be a challenge. And I know that Governor Baker has a history of being able to work across the aisle, but I think this is completely different outside of Massachusetts.
So do you think that student athletes will be thinking about who the head of the NCAA is as this transition happens?
I think some will, because I think some understand the implications, particularly when you're looking at the revenue-generating sports and athletes, because there's a huge impact on them on what decisions the NCAA makes and how that impacts their ability through the NIL to make revenue. If we go to a system where athletes are being paid, particularly when you look again at the top, particularly basketball and football, given what the coaches make, given what the administrators make, it seems unfair. Yes, the students often, not always, but often get college education, but they should get more than that, given how much they're generating. So I think they're going to care.
And to put it in perspective for listeners, let's say you're a Big Ten football coach, you could be making anywhere between $6 and $8 million. Nick Saban famously made more than $10 million a year,
right,
as a college football coach. So, Victor, I'm going to turn to you here. Beth just brought up this reputation of Charlie Baker as a bridger. Here's a little bit more himself from the press conference yesterday.
This role in particular, the way I see it at this point, is it's about being the convener and the collaborator of a very large organization that has a lot of points of view, and seeking to find those places where people can come together, can agree, and can make a case generally to the public, to their student athletes, to their alumni and their fans, about what the best way to ensure that we don't lose this jewel going forward.
So bear with me, Victor, because that's a lot of emphasis on the sort of the peacemaking, the bridge building. And much is being made about the fact that Charlie Baker is the new president of the NCAA, is the first politician to hold that role. Traditionally, we see athletic directors in that role, or we see former presidents of universities, such as the person that he's replacing as he comes in. At the same time, I'm mindful, Andrew Zimbalist, you're both economists, right? This is a business. And we do know Charlie Baker ran Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. He worked in administration and finance in the state, health and human services in the state. The skill sets that come together here, is there anyone who would have had them in this moment?
Yeah, so I think I totally agree with Andy here that I think fairly highly of Charlie Baker myself. I don't know that he's the right guy, but I don't know that anyone is the right person here. There's just so many challenges coming from both inside the NCAA and outside. And again, I think Andy's exactly right. The reason that he's hired is the NCAA has shown that they can't win in court. They can't win in the court of public opinion, just like Beth is saying, that there are significant issues related to the treatment of different groups of athletes, particularly women athletes. So maybe their best hope is, can you get someone that can at least win over the Congress, win over the legislature, and get some concessions that will allow the NCAA to operate kind of as business as usual for them. And it's going to take a pretty heroic act on Baker's part and some big legislation on the part of Congress to have things operate the way they always have.
Beth, what advice would you give the governor?
I have no idea, because I would not know where to start with this. But I do think listening to the voices of the athletes is important to really hear what they have to say, what's going to work for them. I think making sure there is a diverse group of people, and not just by race or gender, but a variety of perspectives at the table, because, you know, we think a lot about the power sports, but they're not the majority of athletes or sports teams in the NCAA. And so how do we make sure that there is more equity in thinking about the NCAA? And I think that comes from making sure those voices are at the table and don't get drowned out by the folks that maybe have more access to the purse strings. And that's a big challenge, I think, for the NCAA and a lot of schools, because the revenue to support the sports programs comes from the programs that are making the revenue, right? And so that's why those folks have the power. And how do you disrupt that so you can really think about what is truly fair and equitable for the student athletes across all three divisions?
And Andrew Zimbalist, one piece of advice, you know, a couple sentences that you would add to what Beth Chandler's just laid out.
Well, very quickly, two things. One area where Charlie has some comparative advantages in health and safety because of his work with Harvard Pilgrim, and that's an area of a major challenge right now for college sports. Concussions, sexual harassment. There are over 100 concussion lawsuits against the NCAA right now, so hopefully that will be an area where he can make a contribution. In terms of broader advice, if he's going to get an antitrust exemption through Congress, it's only going to be part of a comprehensive and coherent bill. And so he's got to, before he starts lobbying in Congress, he's got to start understanding, spend a lot of time studying the system of college sports that we have in this country.
All right, we're going to end it there. Andrew Zimbalist is professor of sports economics at Smith College. Victor Matheson, professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross, and here in Studio 2, YW president and CEO and former collegiate and pro basketball player Beth Chandler. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
She was influential but dismissed, radical but indifferent on some of the biggest issues of her time. Rich, visionary, disruptive, entitled. I'm talking about Isabella Stewart Gardner. Most people know her museum for the 1990 heist that's never been solved, but it turns out her collections there literally changed what's in art museums all around the country. As the museum plans for its next century, it seemed like time to take a modern look at the local icon who may have been remembered for the wrong things. With us now, authors of a new biography, Isabella Stewart Gardner, A Life. Diana Sieve is the interim William and Leah Porvu curator of the collection at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and Nat Silver is the former curator of the museum and now the director of the Hancock Shaker Village in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Diana, welcome here in Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And Nat, we've got you on the line. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So fascinating book here, right? Redefinition of a woman for me as somebody who sort of thought I knew who she was. Diana, you have described Isabella Stewart Gardner as almost a funhouse mirror of a person. So tell us, why do you feel that? Why is she a funhouse mirror?
That's a really great question. And the first thing I'll start with is that Isabella Stewart Gardner was really deliberate about, certainly later in life, cultivating an aura of myth around herself. As early as 1891, we have kind of complaints in the newspapers that there aren't enough images of this kind of well-known socialite. She doesn't leave a lot of primary sources behind her, very little explanation as to why the museum looks the particular way it looks. And she does things like walk a lion in Copley Square. She is a show person. And so trying to navigate what is myth that she's cultivating, what is myth that then gets picked up in journalism, in history, which often comes through quite a sexist lens, and what's real Isabella is quite the challenge for a historian.
And Nat Silver, I want to pick up on what Diana just said. So you do get this air of a little bit of a carnival barker almost, right? Like a P.T. Barnum kind of dimension to her. Clearly the sexism, right? She's known as Mrs. Jack, which is she doesn't even get to have her own first name, let alone last name. But the other thing that really struck me was it turns out her choices about the art that she brought into her home, which she eventually turns into a museum, were kind of transformative for what art curation, art collection in America looked like. I had no idea she had that kind of influence, Nat.
Absolutely. She had an outsized influence on the taste for art across the United States. I mean, first and foremost, she was the first woman to build a museum in the United States. And it's important not to forget that. That was her platform. And then the objects that she brought into it were pioneering. They were pathbreaking in her own day. Think of most museums today, there's a small core of Italian Renaissance pictures in their collection. She was the one who made that the norm. She brought the first Raphael painting to this country. She brought the first Botticelli to this country. One wasn't enough. She ultimately had three. Same with Raphael. She brought the first work by Giotto, by Simone Martini. The list goes on and on, but it changed forever the taste in art in the United States.
So, Diana, it struck me just now when Nat said she's the first woman to build a museum in the United States. Have women often built museums in the United States since then? Is that like a thing? Or is she a first and one of the only? I literally don't know.
I wouldn't say she's one of the only, but she definitely is among kind of a limited core of people. I mean, we have sort of her era, the Cooper Hewitt is created. That's created by two sisters, but it's not a purpose-built museum. You know, you have Peggy Guggenheim, let's say, right? The Guggenheim Foundation in Venice. There are definitely—
I forgot that was Peggy Guggenheim. Yeah. Woman Guggenheim, right.
But she is, it's still a small roster. And what's most important is— she, you know, she was a trailblazer. She really is the earliest woman to embark on this project of a purpose-built museum in the United States.
So Nat Silver, and again, we're speaking with Diana Sieve Greenwald and Nat Silver. They're taking a new look at Isabella Stewart Gardner, who turned out to be, I think iconic is understating it, and also incredibly influential in the art world here in the United States. It was interesting that the two of you chose to take this now, you know, sort of 21st century look at with a new, more modern lens at Isabella Stewart Gardner. And it was striking to me because there were sense of admiration sometimes, but you were pretty clear-eyed on things like her personal fortune was not derived from profits made by enslaving people, but her position and status came from coming from a family where that's where the money was made. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Oh, no, go ahead, Diana. Why don't you jump in?
Jump in, Diana.
I can hop in on that one. So just to be completely clear, so we did want to look into the sources of Gardner's wealth. We went all the way back through her family tree. There's no wealth derived from enslavement that's coming to Isabella Stewart Gardner.
Right.
However, she does have two ancestors, a maternal great-grandfather and a maternal grandfather. Paternal great-grandfather, maternal grandfather, who do enslave people before she's born.
So and that wealth gives them a social status that her family then builds on over time.
And that's what we wanted to emphasize. But Nat can feel free to hop in here, but yeah. I think what we also really wanted to point out is she is part of a class that has just enough capital at the beginning of industrialization in the United States. This is true of her husband, too, that they can invest in enterprises, not always the most friendly ones. You know, we're talking mines and railroads, to just earn enormous wealth as the owners of this capital. It really is the era of earning passive wealth and huge wealth inequality in this country. And they're kind of on, for themselves, the right side of acquiring that wealth that enables the type of activity like building a museum.
And that's Jack Gardner, who we might refer to as Mrs. Isabella for the rest of this conversation. But Nat, do jump in here, especially because the other thing that was striking in your look at her was while she was iconoclastic, while she was idiosyncratic, she took a pass on some of the really big issues of her day at the same, other than immigration. We'll come back to immigration in a minute. But she had the luxury to be in when she wanted to be in and out when she wanted to be out, Nat.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, so just building on what Diana is saying, know, this is the moment of the Industrial Revolution, and these are major beneficiaries of it. So when we're talking about the creation of wealth during the Gilded Age in the United States, you know, there's necessarily, you know, connections to the types of to enslaved labor, to the types of labor practices, which we certainly would not condone today. And that is across the board. That's the history of wealth creation in this country. You know, as you already stated, Gardner's wealth was not connected to the trade and enslaved people, but certainly, you know, she profited from people who had built wealth through labor practices that would not be the norm or be condoned today. And as you say, Tiziana, absolutely, she took, you know, she leaves a very piecemeal record for us to draw conclusions from. She didn't leave behind a lot of her correspondence. In fact, many, she asked people to burn some of her correspondence. She burned some of her correspondence. You know, we're working with a diverse array of source materials, travel albums, photographs, guest books, some letters in particular to her art advisor, Bernard Berenson, but also to some of her friends, Henry James, Whistler, the painter, for example, Charles Martin Loeffler, the composer. You know, she really cultivated friendships with some of the most extraordinarily talented people of her time, artists of all media and across the spectrum, not just in the United States, but across the globe. You could say that she almost collected these friendships and collected people in the same way that she collected art.
So I do find it interesting that, you know, okay, so she is famously known for taking this to her home, turning it into a museum, and we can touch on this again in a minute, you know, turning into a museum and then basically saying, don't touch anything, don't move anything, you can never do anything to this, right? So pretty clear that she had a legacy she wanted to save. So Diana Sieve Greenwald, I'm driving in this morning, I'm hearing a promotional for Here and Now this afternoon where they're talking about a jazz legend who recorded a lot of himself because he had a sense that someday somebody was going to write a story and he wanted to write his own. Here we have a woman who makes a point of walking a lion, right, in downtown Boston and showing up in inappropriate places in Red Sox gear, right? But she burns evidence of who she really was. What do we make of that?
You know, I think kind of the irony of this and the great gift. So keep in mind that during Gardner's lifetime, the museum is actually called Fenway Court. It's only renamed the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, or kind of its full name is revealed upon her death. And so we kind of have to talk about her for the rest of our lives, right? It's founded for the enjoyment of the public forever. But the particular design of the Gardner, where there's really no labels, where it's a particular installation where you're kind of transported to a different place in the middle of Boston, is almost a hands-off approach where I'm giving you an experience and you get to take away from it what you will. And I think Gardner treats her legacy a little bit in the same way. I'm going to give you my name. I'm going to give you some pieces of evidence, but I will let you think of me what you will. And if you think I'm a trailblazer, that's great. If you think I'm an iconoclast, I'm okay with that. You know, it's a for someone who seems so controlling for having passed a rule that or having created a will that nothing should move, there's a little bit of a laissez-faire approach there too, which I find really fascinating.
You sound a little bit admiring of it.
Yeah, I'm very admiring of it. I will say, I think as someone who's a curator at the museum, I've really come to respect her curatorial genius. She disliked the kind of staid encyclopedic museum model that was developing in many museums around the country, kind of just across the fens at the MFA Boston. She wanted to create experience. And we're seeing that in museums, that is what often draws people in. They should be experiential places to enjoy yourself, whatever that means, in front of artwork. And so she's kind of being proven right in her curatorial approach, I think, 100 years later.
So Nat Silver, go.
Oh, I think it's also really interesting that, you know, she did leave a lot open, but she was also extremely deliberate about what she chose to share, just as she was deliberate about burning some letters. She was deliberate about cultivating certain kinds of press attention, like the lion incident that you mentioned. You know, she chooses to do that. She knows it's going to solicit a big reaction. But then when you work on a biography like this, you want to dig down and try to figure out, you know, why did she do that? You know, is she trying to create a splash? Well, yes, certainly. But why is that useful for her and the kind of reputation and the image that she's attempting to cultivate more publicly? Well, for one, you know, it's it's an intrepid thing to do. And it certainly speaks to the kind of travel, for example, that she did throughout her life. She traveled to 37 countries in her lifetime. This is someone who died in 1924. I mean, that alone is pretty remarkable. And her personality, in many ways, you know, was very brave. She embarked on new ventures. She made investments in new areas, for instance, in her collecting or in the building of a museum that she didn't know if they would be successful or pan out in the end, but they were, you know, and I think one of the things that anecdote shows us is that she's willing to take risks, but they're calculated risks, and she knows what she's looking for coming out of them.
We're talking with authors and museum curators Nat Silver and Diana Sieve Greenwald about their new book, Isabella Stewart Gardner, A Life. Diana, I'm glad that Nat brought up the fact that Stewart Gardner traveled, you know, 37 countries, died in 1924. One of the places that she did really step forward on policy, you know, in the early 1920s, that was the rash of really kind of stunning now anti-immigration policies that were passed at the federal level, quotas and reductions and some of the first policies we'd ever put on our books. She was pro-immigration. She stepped forward on that. She also curated art from parts of the world that other museums weren't, whether it was Chinese art or maybe it was an emphasis on Spanish art. And given that you can't change anything, but that the world of art is now grappling with who was invisible in art before, did she do enough that this museum can walk forward in the new century and stay relevant as we open our aperture of where art comes from? Do you understand my question?
Absolutely. And I think she did. And I think it's sort of our growing institutional understanding of just how global our collection is. For a really long time, and you know, for good reason, people have placed an emphasis on the Italian Renaissance collection and how revolutionary it was. And we've kind of been seen as, oh, a Venetian palazzo in Boston. But we're learning that we're so much more than that. And I'll give a plug for a show that we're opening this February that really engages with Gardner's travels. You know, we have a massive Japanese art collection, a Chinese art collection. And through the work on this biography, we've learned that she was also at the forefront of those collecting practices. So not only do we have significant holdings, but we have ones that were trailblazing as well. And I think it's our job at the Gardner to help visitors understand that, and really highlight those works from a range of different cultures and places that maybe we haven't done to a greater extent before.
So before I let you go, just in 10 seconds, I do want to say the word botany as well, Nat, because there is this whole other dimension, which was her work with plants.
Yes, she had a massive garden at her house outside of Boston in Brookline called Green Hill. She cultivated, well, what she called a Japanese garden. She had a number of greenhouses. Of course, most iconically, and the reason today that we associate gardening with her is because of the incredible courtyard in the center of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum.
All right.
That keeps that experience alive 365 days a year.
Nat Silver, former curator at the Gardner and now director of Hancock Shaker Village, Diana Sieve Greenwald, the interim William and Leah Porvu, curator of the collection at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tiziana Deering here on Radio Boston, and we have just had a mad scramble over about 2 minutes to get all the supplies in here to talk a little bit about this.
You name it, I can make it.
Could I get an old-fashioned?
Classic. Rum and Coke coming right in.
And could I get a Moscow Mule?
Rum and Coke for my comrade.
I'll have a whiskey
rum
sour.
Coke coming right up.
Could I get a rum and Coke?
A Pepsi, okay.
Okay, you don't want that to be you at a holiday gathering, whether you're serving alcoholic drinks or non-alcoholic drinks. And our friend Lonnie Newburn from the Boston Shaker is here to help us not make the same mistake as Joe Swanson from The Family Guy. Also still with us here in the studio, our guest from the conversation about Charlie Baker and the NCAA, still with us, Beth Chandler, president and CEO of YW, who's going to help us taste today. Thanks for sticking with us, Beth.
I'm excited.
Okay, and I want to let everybody know, radioboston.org, we are streaming this right now. You can see Lonnie, Beth, and me. You can follow along, learn how to make both a mocktail and a cocktail that we're doing today. Lonnie, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to get nostalgic for a second because I was thinking yesterday, the first time I mixed winter drinks with you, it's COVID. I'm alone in a home office that I've got set up as a studio. I've gone out in the darkness and gotten all the ingredients. And there I am mixing with you alone, right? Nobody's going to taste it. It's for New Year's Eve. We're 3 years into this pandemic now. People are approaching this season right now with, should I get together? Should I not get together? These are drinks for serving together. Are you finding that people want to be together and want to hold these kinds of holiday parties in person this year?
Oh, absolutely. In the shop, we're constantly helping folks make drinks for themselves or gatherings. And this year, it seemed like it was cocktails for a crowd. Everybody wanted something that was simple and easy to make, not using a lot of ingredients, and so they could serve their guests easily when they arrive.
And I think, you know, again, if you're watching now here on RadioBoston.org, you'll see we do have a simple set of ingredients. And Lonnie has brought stuff in so that I can learn alongside you. I'm very excited about
that.
Okay, so let's start with, what are winter cocktail ingredients, you know, sort of key ones? And are they the same for holiday? Like, do you do the same kinds of cool things in February that you would at in December, or are they different spices and seasonings?
There's definitely some seasonal seasonings and drinks out there. I think for the holidays, you want to kind of round out cocktails that have a little bit more of a darker cinnamon, maybe a gingerbread flavor, things that tie into the Christmas or holiday feel. You know, come February, there's other types of drinks that people have when it's cold out. Kind of the mocktail here, we're going to follow along with more of a bitter aperitif style drink. So things that are red and using seasonal ingredients.
I'm glad that you brought in a mocktail as well. We had a conversation here earlier in the week on Radio Boston about creating friendly, supportive, and celebrative spaces for people regardless of whether they want to be drinking or not.
Oh, totally. We have a whole section of the Boston Shaker now for just non-alcoholic ingredients.
Fantastic. We also had a conversation with a local distiller, Bully Boy Distillery, yesterday, and they were talking about ready-to-drink cocktails.
Correct.
You also, obviously, as the Boston Shaker, are, you know, sort of make them as you go. Is there anything you really shouldn't pre-make and store in your fridge
actually,
or freezer?
Both of these are going to be ready to drink. We're kind of following that same similar path. It is very popular and easy for folks at home just to add, you know, kind of one liquid at a time. Definitely was looking for Bully Boy's new bourbon. We're going to be using a bourbon today in this cocktail. So both of these are going to be easy to measure and shake in just one step.
So depending on which brother you ask, by the way, when Bully Boy, the new bourbon will either be out in 2024 or 2023.
Exactly.
The distiller brother wants 2024. The business brother wants 2023. So we'll have to wait and see.
Good things take time.
Beth, is there a seasonal drink that you particularly enjoy this time of year?
I'm an eggnog fan, actually.
Oh, yeah. I'll be making some. It's a tradition of mine. I'll do the Morgenthaler eggnog, which is sherry and tequila.
Nice. Oh. Okay, and so now I can fully reveal my eggnog ignorance because I am allergic to eggs.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, is there any egg in eggnog?
This one, yeah, you're going to use some raw eggs and cream for sure. There's other options out there, I think, that are more vegan.
Okay.
No eggs in the drinks here today.
All right, so let's start with the cocktail and teach us all, including those who are watching right now on RadioBoston.org, teach us how to do this.
Yeah, we'll do it step by step.
Okay.
This one's pretty approachable. At the Boston Shaker, we certainly help folks make drinks at home and answer all their questions, but we also help folks when they have a cocktail out at like the bar they enjoy to kind of break that down. And the number one cocktail we get requested is the Bourbon Spice Rack.
Ooh, that sounds tasty.
It's a delicious cocktail. It's a sour, which is a take on the whiskey sour.
Mm-hmm.
So originally, we'll put the recipe online, but it's bourbon,
okay.
It's lemon and sugar, and that's your basic formula for a whiskey sour.
Okay.
And because it has lemon, we're going to shake it. The difference is we are using like a grade B Vermont maple syrup for the sugar, so
ooh,
it's going to add a little richness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of this Amaro called Cardamaro in there that's going to add another seasonal spice.
Okay.
But instead of measuring all those ingredients out individually, we've actually pre-batched this in this little bottle.
It's nice. Should I keep it chilled? It's a cool bottle.
Absolutely.
But I don't know if that's just because you came from outside.
You can, but we're going to shake it up with ice. So
okay.
The only thing that's not in here is water. So
what's in here?
I've just measured out the ingredients, so you basically doubled it here. So there's two cocktails in here.
Okay.
With the bourbon, the lemon, the Cardamaro, and the maple syrup.
And again, we're going to put this recipe
online. Yeah,
online.
Yeah, we have it all for you.
So I'm going to pop it open.
Yep, pop it open. So instead of adding all those individual ingredients, we're just going to add this one ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to use that, or to measure, we're going to use a jigger here.
I can smell it already.
Yeah.
It smells like winter.
Allspice,
yes. Yeah, yeah, okay.
So the measuring device we have is a jigger.
Yeah.
It's a 1 ounce over 2 ounce jigger.
Okay.
And most classic cocktails, in fact, all of them, are 3 ounces of total liquid.
Okay.
So our first step is to fill up the 2 ounce side once.
That's the big one.
Yep. And the 1 ounce side, and we're going to pour that right into our mixing glass.
So we want 3 ounces, so we're going to use both sides of this jigger.
That's correct.
We're going to put it in the large glass?
Actually, if you were building a cocktail at a bar, you want to pour it actually in the small side.
In the little one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to fill the 2 ounces. Beth, have you ever mixed a cocktail before?
I have not, so I'm fascinated by this.
We have all the tools here. This is a sour, so we're going to measure, we're going to shake, and we're going to strain.
Okay.
Using the tools.
So I poured the 2 ounce side in. Now I'm going to pour the one. I'm very stressed about spilling.
Oh, don't worry.
I'm not going to lie.
We're in the studio. It's okay.
Yeah, but this is like precious ingredient. Yep, I spilled.
But there that's the point of this. It's easy to measure one thing. It's okay if you spill even around your guests.
Okay.
But there is a little one extra step, and that's because there's no water. You do have to shake this up to wake it up. You have to make it cool. You got to mix everything together. So now we're actually going to add the one kind of, and there's no garnish on this, but we're going to add one extra step, which are the bitters.
Okay.
And these are basically the spice rack of the cocktail world.
Yeah.
The, what makes the bourbon spice rack unique is it combines lavender and cardamom bitters to really give it a full flavor.
So you've got a bottle of lavender bitters. It says lavender very clearly on the front.
And it's like a hot sauce bottle. You just invert it bounce it twice.
Okay.
2 to 3 times.
All right.
And you're going to dash that right in your cocktail.
So here I go, my lavender bitters. Yep. And again, if you want to watch along, radioboston.org to do that. Okay.
This is an original cocktail from the Barcelona Wine Bar. So we're following one of the most popular.
Yep.
And the other bitters we have is our famous cardamom bitters. And again, this is another local one that we carry.
Smell
at
this.
The shop, yeah.
That smell, that smell, it smells amazing.
Yeah, that's green cardamom. It has cinnamon. There's some tea in there.
Yeah,
I mean, so this is a concentrate and cardamom.
So. Exactly. Yeah.
All right, so that's just splash, bloop, bloop, bloop.
So we're basically seasoning our cocktail, just like a hot sauce bottle.
Okay.
And these are going to bind the ingredients, but also add a nice layer of flavor.
Okay.
And when you're ready, you have some tongs right here.
All
right,
put some ice.
After you, yeah. The last thing you want to add is the ice.
One big chunk? That's a big chunk.
That's
of
for
ice.
Our glasses. Grab the small ones if possible.
A little baby ice. How many?
You want to fill that all the way up to the top.
Holy cow.
So about four cubes.
I got to get busy here.
You're right. Okay. 4 to 5 cubes is all we're looking for.
Two.
And it's just going to be because the ice has 3 jobs. It's going to mix everything together, obviously chill this drink. But overall, it needs to add a little bit of water, about 20% dilution, to make it balanced.
Now, Lonnie, one of the things that I learned from you another time when you were here is that one does not then, and I don't know if you knew this, Beth, one does not then use the ice from the mixing glass, or in the mixing container, as the ice in the beverage glass.
Correct. That's technically dirty ice. We're going to use this once to shake, and I've already got a big cue waiting for you in your glass.
Okay.
So what we're going to do next is take our big tin.
Our big tin.
And we're going to put it on top of our small tin.
Putting it on top of the small tin here. Oh, I feel so professional.
Making sure that we have a flat side. It's not going to be vertical. You want it actually a slight angle.
It's for a seal.
Yep. Correct.
Okay.
And then give it a little tap on top.
Worried about spilling.
You'll be fine.
Well, I can tap it. Boop.
Yep. All right. Then the first step is turn it over.
Oh, dude, you're freaking me out.
And your right hand or your dominant hand on top.
Okay.
And then you want to shake over that same shoulder. So just over your right shoulder. You want to go back and forth. For about 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And the shorter you shake it, the faster you can go.
Okay.
And so you want to shake that. You'll feel the tin getting cold.
Oh, it's getting very cold. Yeah. And I'm not spilling.
No, you're not. It's got a great seal. All right.
All right.
And then we're done.
Mom, my hands almost hurt from the cold.
Actually, turn it over so you have the small side on top.
Small side on top. Okay.
Flat side orient towards you.
Flat side toward me.
And then hold it just like you're clapping. You want to hit the side of the tin to release the top.
Okay.
Like that. Try hitting it right here on this side on the big tin.
Hit the big tin.
Right there. Perfect.
And there. Look, you got it. Listened. Okay, so.
Such a pro.
So the bottom one, not the one that's stuck in there, you hit the bottom one.
You build in the small tin, and then since you have more liquid, you always strain out of the big tin.
Okay, so now which glass am I pouring?
We're going to take our Hawthorne strainer on top. This is invented in Boston, and you're going to strain in the glass that's closest to you there.
All right.
And you're going to put that on top, hold it with one finger.
Okay.
And it's going to hold back all the ice.
Can I pour a little into a glass for Beth?
I have it right here for
you. Great. Thank you very much. And I'm going to pour right in here.
Well done.
All right. You know, I poured a little too much. I want to save some for the team.
Oh, that's...
And I'm not going to drink all that anyway.
But this, exactly. So we got a little rocks glass. We have a large 2-inch cube on there. We're not using the ice we shook with. We poured over fresh ice to have a nice cold cocktail.
Cheers.
Cheers, Beth. Cheers, TCM.
Now, Beth, you taste first and let us know what you think.
Oh, yes. So the bourbon spice rack.
Oh, it smells like... Oh, I don't know.
It's a really rich allspice whiskey sour. Yep.
This is divine.
Yeah.
The cardamaro is like a rich, kind of sherry-like amaro. The maple syrup darkens it. Again, we have this bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup. And no garnish, because the bitters kind of act as the flavoring garnish.
So it's sour and also sweet at the same time.
It is.
And kind of tastes a little pine tree without really being spruce.
Yes, exactly. That's going to be from the amaro and even some of the cardamom bitters. But it adds a little bit of a hint of that seasonal spice to a kind of tart cocktail, the sour.
All right, so teach us now, while we enjoy the aftertaste of that, which is fabulous, teach us to make the mocktail. I want to make sure we get this.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be another easy one. This is a ready-to-drink. We actually carry something in the shop called the Phony Negroni.
Phony Negroni. Negroni is the big thing.
Right. So where we did the sour before, a lot of palates are changing to more bitter and actually things that are a little drier.
And Negroni, I'm assuming, is a bitter, dry drink?
Correct. So the original Negroni is equal parts gin, vermouth, and Campari. And Campari is a very... dry cocktail. You got a pair of teeth that's like bitter orange.
Yeah.
This one replicates all those flavors and is slightly effervescent. So some people would call it even like a Spagliato because it has no alcohol, a slight effervescence, and we're just going to take this and pour it right over our
next glass. So this is an RTD. This is a ready-to-drink Negroni.
Yeah, this is from the New York Times. The Wirecutter called this one of the best non-alcoholic cocktails that's ready to go.
All right.
And this
is just pour this straight in the other one.
Absolutely. This is a rich red cocktail. It looks beautiful. It could be celebratory like champagne.
Wait, listen to that fizz.
Oh, yeah.
There it is.
It could be before a drink. It could certainly be after. And yeah, this definitely applies to more of a bitter palate. The final step here, there is a little touch, again, if you were showing off for your friends or family coming over.
So you are using a peeler and taking an orange peel.
Yeah, I took a wide peeler and I went north to south on this orange to give you this swath.
Thank you. And it smells so good.
Yes. The fresh citrus is a really pulls this together. This is the garnish. And you just take your swath with the skin side towards your cocktail glass.
Yeah.
And you actually just want to pinch it kind of like a canoe. And it's going to express all the orange oil over the top of the glass.
So I don't feel like anything's coming out.
You got it. You got a little crease there. You're doing great. And you want to do that on your phony Negroni to give it more of a rich.
Oh, one.
That's all right. We have more oranges here if you need it.
No, that I got it. Good.
So it's going to give it a little more of a citrus flavor.
There we go.
And especially if it was strong, kind of bitter, even though this is a mocktail.
So, but Beth, do we have some for you there, Beth, too?
Yeah.
Great. Let's give you a little orange, too.
You got it.
While you give Beth some orange, I'm going to taste this one.
Please do.
So, A, wildly different than the other drink.
Correct. Right? So this is for the other palate.
The other one was sweet and sour. This is bitter and sweet.
Yeah, I get a lot of bitter orange. Kind of that rosé taste.
Yeah.
Very floral.
Yeah, and mild. Yes.
It is. It is. And you can taste the Campari in there.
And that's what they're emulating, because Campari technically is alcoholic. Right. So this is for those folks who are obviously not drinking at all. And this is going to give them that same bracing flavor so they can enjoy. A Negroni is very hard to replicate.
So a Negroni, though, a non-alcoholic one, if it's a good one, is a great solution, it sounds like, if you want to serve a real cocktail, non-alcoholic beverage to your guests.
Correct. This has got the body of a really strong drink without the alcohol.
Over the holidays, what's the special one you're going to make for yourself?
I do a lot of seasonal ones, old fashions. I'm actually going to do the eggnog. I'm going to pre-batch it just like we did here, so it's ready to go, pour over ice. But I am a Negroni drinker, so this holiday, definitely going to be doing the gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari.
So, Beth, of those two, flavor-wise, which one speaks to you more for wintertime?
The bourbon one.
Yeah.
Bourbon one was
and
good.
And that's kind of a in the evening at home kind of slow drink, right?
Absolutely. Once the sour is completed, you can make all the shaken drinks, and it's nice and easy to make anytime.
All right, and your must-have ingredient in the house for the winter?
Honestly, at the Shaker, we're doing a lot of bitters, and they don't go bad. They're like spices on your cocktail bar cart. And aromatic bitters that have a lot of cinnamon and clove and allspice are really easy to add to any cocktail to really make it taste more like the season.
All right. So Lonnie, I want to say cheers and thank you for being here. Lonnie Newburn is the owner of the Boston Shaker. It's a craft cocktail shop in Somerville. A couple of times a year, comes in and teaches us just how to try something wonderful and new. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Beth Chandler, thank you for staying in and sampling with us, trying this new stuff and being kind of our neighbor.
You're welcome. This was wonderful.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. That's our show for today. Hey, everybody, thanks for listening. Tune in again Monday for more Radio Boston.